Hello, and welcome to Teacher Tales, a podcast from the spirit of teaching. This is your host, Linda Markley, and I invite you to join me and my guests as we get curious, explore, discover, and learn more about what is really at the heart of teaching. In each episode, we will hear the story of a teacher, what called them to teach, what are their greatest joys and challenges in teaching, what inspires them, and what are their hopes, dreams, and vision for the education of children. We will learn more about the greatest lessons they have taught and also the greatest lessons they have learned. No checklists, no standards, no reports, no paperwork, and no data. Just stories from their hearts to our hearts on a journey to celebrate what really matters in the true spirit of teaching. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Teacher Tales. Again, I'm so excited that you have decided to join us for more inspiration from another fabulous educator. This time, we're going to take a little bit of a different look and a different perspective. Our guest today is from the post-secondary level. And I know for all of the elementary teachers and secondary school teachers, this is what we're preparing the kids for, is that post-secondary journey and education. And we don't always understand that world. We've been there ourselves, but sometimes we forget about it and we don't understand that perspective. So we have a guest today that's going to enlighten us on some of those things and also talk about a fabulous podcast that he has as well. So Grant, want to introduce yourself?
Hey, my name is Grant Gearhart, and I'm a Spanish professor at Georgia Southern University. I've been teaching Spanish for 20 years. This marks my 20th year, so two decades. I got interested in Spanish, like I think most kids in high school. I had a really positive, enthusiastic high school teacher named Geneva Story, and I grew up in Kentucky. And Miss Story was the math teacher. She was also the Spanish teacher. I'm from a very, very small town with a very small public high school. And I took my very first Spanish class with her as a ninth grader. Every year, the big event in Spanish was you get to take a trip to Murray State University to participate in a Spanish or a language competition. And she had never had anyone really sign up for the conversation competition. Everyone was doing arts and crafts and singing and posters. And I said, you know, I'll give that a try. And it turns out I won. I didn't think I did any good at all. And that kind of got me hooked, right? I was like, oh, well, maybe there's something here. And then Miss Story took a detour and took, a position with the district. Anyway, she left my sophomore year. And so I took a very dry Spanish 2 class. It was a lot of verb charts, a lot of, you know, fill in the blanks. It wasn't very dynamic. And we didn't offer Spanish 3 or 4, but Miss Story allowed me to take Spanish 3 and 4 as an independent study when I was a junior and senior because I was so enthusiastic about it. And then she took a group of us to Mexico it was my very first time out of the country, I think for most of us. And we did a tour of Mexico. So that was my first experience abroad. And I got to use what little language I knew at that time, but it was really fun. So I went to do my bachelor's degrees at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee, and studied economics and Spanish there. And I played basketball on the varsity team at Suwanee. And when I was about to graduate, my head coach said, well, what are your plans after graduation? What do you think you want to do? And so I have no idea, you know, maybe something in banking or international banking, but I'm not too excited about that. He said, I think you should try coaching. You'd be a good coach. Well, how do I do that? How do I get to be a coach? He said, well, go be a teacher. So, well, what can I teach? He said, Spanish. And at that time, that was 2003, and there was a tremendous shortage of Spanish teachers. Not just in public schools, or which I had no certification, but in private schools. And that's where I got my start. So I started teaching high school Spanish at private schools and coaching basketball and kind of quickly realized that my heart was more in the Spanish classroom than it was on the basketball court at that stage. So I decided I was at that time I was living in Charlotte, North Carolina, decided, well, let me if I want to do this, if I want to be a Spanish teacher, let's do it right. Let's go to grad school and at least start with a master's. And so I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, started my master's, and from there continued on with my PhD and sort of found my way into higher education that way. So it's been a very long but fruitful journey, just more in the sense that I've met some incredible people along the way. I've had some fantastic students and great overall life experiences that were really opened up to me because of this interest in studying another language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what studying another language does, is opens doors. It did for me as a kid whose parents never traveled. I never went anywhere. We were very poor. And I could at least travel through the language and through the books that I read, and then eventually got to travel for real and then pass it on to students as well. So what Miss Story, right, was your teacher, mm-hmm. did for you, what a great story, no pun intended, but she did kind of create your story with that foundation and that spark. And that's what teachers do. And we don't reach every student. And I think that's something that I want to say to teachers listening, is you're not going to reach every student, but oh, what a great feeling when you do reach that one. And it does make a complete difference in their life for forever. And sets them on a path. And that's the power of teaching and passing it on to the next generation of students for a hopeful future and everything. So thank you. And I'm glad you did a shout out to her and everything. And so what are you doing now in the post-secondary realm? You're at Georgia Southern and you're teaching, obviously, college level courses. Mm-hmm. So
my interests are pretty varied as far as, I guess, an academic would go in languages. You know, the academic part, I'm a medievalist and a Renaissance scholar. That's what I focused my literary research on in graduate school. So I've published several papers on topics related to medieval chivalry in Spain. That's sort of my area. But like I said, I have diverse interests. So I'm really interested in pedagogy with my high school experience. And then I guess my interest in pedagogy, I've just kind of been rotated into being the person who teaches the foreign language methods class at our MA/MAT program that we have, which if you're looking for a master's program or an MAT program, it's a great program. It's fully online, but we have as much synchronous components as we can with students, so they have a chance to be together and be with us in a live setting, even if it's virtual. So I've been exploring a lot more in the world of language teaching pedagogy, especially kind of tangible things to give my students who are going into the classroom. So, like, for example, you made a great point about, you know, teachers can't reach every single student. And I tell my students that my master students, that I say, you know, there are going to be times when you're going to be a little down because you feel like the students don't care, but no one bats 1,000, right? No teacher bats 1,000. It's impossible. But think in terms of like being a fisherman or a fisher person, just cast the net as wide as you can and you'll catch as many as you can. And your job in a course in about language teaching, or if you go to a conference like where we met at FLAG, Foreign Language Association of Georgia, or you do a professional development webinar, think about that in terms of like, I'm increasing the size of my net, I'm expanding my abilities to catch more fish, to kind of get them into that perspective of, you're not going to catch all the fish, but the more you learn about teaching, the better a teacher you'll become and the better you'll be able to catch more fish, i.e. you'll be able to reach more students. So I've gotten really interested in language teaching in the last couple of years because of my role in our master's program. That led me to, I guess, start a podcast because I'm really enthusiastic about professional development. We have a conference. It's not a conference. It's called the World Languages Collaborative, and it's just a professional development day that's put on by our district here in Savannah, Chatham County, by Dr. Mark Linsky. And it was in person, then COVID hit, it went virtual. And I just realized that there's so many awesome ideas out there in these little sessions, but they only happen once or twice a year, like once a semester. So would it be cool if we could kind of capture those ideas in something that was a little more cached, a little more archived, like a podcast? So what I do is I try to interview teachers and get ideas from them and archive them in a podcast that other teachers can go to anytime, whether they're, driving to work or, doing housework or whatever they're doing, shopping, commuting, whatever, lesson planning, just something that you've got a little chunk of time, you can get a little professional development. And I've gotten some great ideas from just doing that podcast that I've tried to, pass on to my students. Teaching wise, like this semester, for example, I'm teaching a Spanish 1 class. We call it 1001. It's 101. And it's one of my favorite courses to teach, even at this stage. I just love the growth of the students from coming in and being novice students and not really knowing much, if anything, and seeing by the end of the term, I've only got them for 15 weeks and I see them twice a week for 75 minutes, how much, we can progress and how far, if I can get them from a novice low or a novice mid to a novice high or intermediate, low. And that's really exciting for me to kind of see what am I doing in class. And I think you mentioned in the beginning sort of what's going on in secondary education, elementary versus university. And I think the main thing is schedules really change. Academic schedules change drastically. And you don't see your students every day, right? You see them 3 times a week, maybe twice a week. So you have to bring in other educational tools to help you kind of facilitate their learning overall. It also means that almost the entire time they're in class with me, we're working on interpersonal and presentational oral communication. We're not spending a lot of time in class reading or even writing, because those are some things that they can do independently outside of class. Class time is just super precious. So trying to stay in the target language as much as possible, comprehensible input as much as possible, just loads and loads of that in the short time that we have. So I think an advantage to secondary teachers in elementary is you have more contact time with students to build that proficiency sort of play by playing the long game.
But I think that, several things I want to go back and revisit and expand on, great points that you made. First of all, the idea of only seeing the kids so many days a week, and you've had to become creative and a little innovative about how you reach them. And the whole idea of the flipped classroom, I think, started with, university professors and stuff. And after the pandemic, a lot of teachers realized that, we don't want to be totally online, but there is some advantage to that. And especially in a language class where you want to maximize your time and interaction in class. So in too many classes, I think we see kids sitting silently and working from a textbook. And that's maybe not the best use of time, especially in a language class, but even in other subject areas, because we're human beings and we're built for connection and we want to communicate with each other and share ideas and bounce ideas off from each other. And so that ties back into your whole idea of collaborative. We as professionals want to be collaborative and share ideas, but I think we forget about that for our students, that, let them collaborate together in groups and in pairs and teach each other and learn from each other. So those were great points. And I really loved your baseball analogy. If I could just, maybe it's send one message out to, not one, but one of many messages to people outside of the teaching profession, because it's under such fire now of being like, teachers are not professionals and they're terrible and they're not delivering and stuff. And I don't think that's true at all. And we don't say that about baseball players. No, look at our star baseball players that are getting $15 million a year that are batting, 400, 300, if that. And we don't, and that's percentage wise, if it's 1,000, with teachers, if we have kids that we only have, maybe have 10, 15%, not in the passing range or whatever, then we're considered a failure. And just do the math on that. And why are we paying all these sports, athletes and everything so much money? and not teachers, when the results, I think, we have a much lower standard for the professional athletes than we do for teachers. So anyways, that's,
yeah, I'd love to make a professional athlete salary. That would be fantastic. But I think you hit on a really good point, is that I was listening to an interview a couple of days ago, and it may actually been one of your, I was, may have been on your podcast. As a matter of fact, I was trying to get a feel for the podcast, and it was brought up, like, this idea of teacher, those who don't do teach, that seems to be the moniker. And, and, you know, of course we're in the profession, so we know that that's hokum. That's not true at all. But teaching, when I have conversations, most of my friends are in business, medicine, or law, right? Most of the people I went to college with are in one of those fields. And I said, well, how many presentations do you give to an audience, say, in a quarter? Or, you know, oh, maybe like three or four. I was like, well, you know, that's what I give in a day, right? And they have to be really prepared and curated. And how do you feel after you give a presentation? I'm usually, you know, pretty tired, ready to go get a cocktail or just chill out or whatever. And I said, exactly. And you have to do this over and over again to adolescents, to kids with raging hormones, to people who aren't, you know, in my case, I do have adults, but if you're in secondary education, you're dealing with kids who are going through, they're not fully mature learners. They're going through all sorts of transitions in life. Now they've got to deal with all the pressures of social media and the internet. So this is probably one of the hardest times, if not the hardest time in the history of education that's ever existed in humanity. And I don't think that's hyperbole. I think that our jobs are tremendously challenging. And we are in a lot of ways undervalued, except when there's sort of, sort of a major success or breakthrough. So I think it's important for us to start developing a marketing mentality and be our own best advocates. I don't think anybody's going to come to save us from the outside, unfortunately. But, I constantly share with people that think, oh, you know, you're a professor, you know, I've got a flexible schedule. And I enjoy that about my job very much. But it just gives me the freedom to work in a way that's best for me. But I'm working all the time, right? Mm-hmm. I'm working on something. I can't, you know, rarely do I say, okay, I'm not going to think about anything related to work. Like it comes home with me. It stays home with me. It's on the commute. I think, and that's pretty true of all teachers. We are always thinking about what we do and how we can be better at it, because we truly are in this because we care. And that's probably one of the reasons that there's so much teacher burnout, is because we care so much. And if you care about something and you don't feel sort of the level of appreciation that perhaps we all deserve, to be frank, it does sort of burn you out. And if your salaries are much lower than they should be, and you see other salaries, it's easy to kind of fall in that trap of, why am I doing this? And I think that's one of the reasons that so many teachers leave the profession. It's a day-to-day grind. It's a daily grind that builds up over weeks. And, you know, it takes stamina and it takes grit to be a teacher, and it takes, commitment. It is something that should be highly, highly valued and praised. More so than it is.
Yeah. And I'd love your point about marketing, because we can't wait for somebody else from the outside to recognize our value, especially right now. Teacher Appreciation Week, we do it this 1 week of the year, and we feel valued. But why should it be 1 week out of the year? And also, why should we wait for others to come and validate us from the outside or make us feel like we're worthwhile? I mean, that's with any human being in any profession, but especially in teaching. And I was just doing a presentation with some teachers a couple of days ago, and talking about ideas, again, collaborating, sharing ideas. And we were talking about a strategy for advocating for their programs. And I said, how many of you invite other teachers in to see what you're doing, or you get involved with, you know, doing some cross-curricular collaboration, or you invite the community to come in and see what you're doing in your classroom. And they're like, no, I don't do any of that. And I'm like, why not? And I think teachers isolate in the classroom and they create a very comfortable cocoon. And so going outside and inviting others in is a little foreign to them and maybe scary, because there is a lot of judgment out there. There is a lot of negative press, so to speak, on teachers and what they do. And everybody seems to want to be an expert and tell the teachers what they're doing wrong rather than what they're doing right. And that is not helpful, but I think it starts with the teacher marketing and inviting people in and showing them, letting them see how hard it is, how much of a, you know, they're trying to coordinate all of these different kids. And now classes are huge, you know, elementary classes. My daughter was telling, she's a fifth grade teacher and she's got 31 kids in a class. That's too many kids. There's not even enough space, and they're bigger kids. I mean, maybe kindergartners, 31 would fit better, but fifth graders, they're really big. And like you said, hormones and all of that stuff. And you're dealing then with the parents and admin and the district. And it is a skill to be able to handle all of that. It really is. And I think of people in businesses, and they can close their door, and they can put out of office on, and they can kind of cocoon and not have to go out. Like you said, with asking how many presentations do you do? You know, they don't have to go out and do presentations or put themselves very vulnerably in front of a group of people like that, which is very difficult. So with that, I wanted to segue into, you teach some classes on language for the professions. And that's a passion of mine. That's how I helped market my classes and make those connections to the real world, was get business partners, get them to come in and talk to the kids. We went and visited the businesses with our state language organization. We had businesses like talk about the importance of languages, and we created little YouTube videos that could be shared. Could you talk a little bit about that, and you know, how important it is? Because, you know, people think that language is where they're trying to defeat it here in Florida with computer science, saying that computer science can count as a world language credit. And no, that's not going to help business as much as world languages. So,
yeah, that's an interesting point. The computer science and the coding is sort of, oh, well, that it can take the place of your language. And that's going to bring me back to this idea of, like, we've got to be our best advocates, because I think there's still, in the larger society, especially with perhaps older segments of the population that will remember this when they studied foreign languages, is it's like all verb charts. It's all about, you know, sort of the Latin model, the model of learning Latin, the declensions and the syntax, and that we've really turned, and it's been, you know, years now, but language is really about communication. It's about culture. It's about understanding people who are different from you. It's a lot of soft skills, right, that are in demand in the business world. It's been proven scientifically to help your brain. You know, I tell students sometimes it's like mental CrossFit or mental gymnastics. It's great for your brain. It's one of the ways that it's a unique way that you can train your brain to help stave off certain types of degenerative brain issues, right? So we've got to reshape the conversation around languages. And I don't know anything about coding. Maybe coding does all that. I doubt it, because, you know, coding, I believe it's more of that sort of syntax, order, understanding symbols and how they fit together. That is a small part about what we do. And it's a part of what we do, I think, at the later stage, should be sort of towards the later stages of language learning. But early on, we need to recognize what are the immediate needs, and it's communication. So languages for specific purposes, languages for the professions, these are all things that get right into the communicative nature of learning a language. You and I don't speak the same language, or maybe I speak part of your native language and maybe you speak part of my native language. We need to communicate. We need to have intercultural understanding of one another. And that's kind of what we do, I think, and the value that we bring to something in a globalized workforce. We sort of are at the front lines of preparing students for that, because we're not just teaching them about it. You go into a certain class maybe, and the book is and the subject is about another culture. We're giving students a pathway into that culture where they can experience it from the inside out, not just look at it from above. I would give a metaphor of someone learning to be a surgeon. It's different. It's one thing to look at the operation from the observation deck above this operation. It's another thing to have your hands on the utensils and be down there with the patient. And that's what we do in languages. Like, we are the surgeons in there with the utensils doing thing with the patients. So that to me is where we can add a lot of value to this sort of discussion about what are languages, what's the point of languages for our sort of local, state, national, world economies and how things function. I got into languages for specific purposes because I knew that this is just the truth, that the profession, the literary scholar profession, is rapidly contracting. And the field that I started out and was interested in was contracting even faster, which is medieval and Renaissance studies. And I needed to sort of expand my professional portfolio. And it seemed like a good fit. I studied economics through college. I've always been interested in business. I think I've always had kind of a business-oriented mind. My parents and grandparents were small business owners, so I grew up in and around businesses. And it's a fascinating aspect of our profession. I think it's going to become, very soon, it will become the bedrock of kind of how we look at the profession as a language teaching profession, is how we can get students ready to communicate professionally. And there will be people who will say, and I see their point, that it's really sad that we've sort of, instead of studying, the great poets or the great writers of that language, we're going to be giving them more tangible skills to use in the workplace. And I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I think there are ways to incorporate both aspects in all sorts of different types of courses. So even if I teach a literature course or a culture course, I try to weave in elements of using Spanish in a professional communicative setting into the curriculum and try to kind of get the best of both worlds. But I see that as sort of being where we are going to be able to make headway in the sort of the way the world looks at education right now, if that makes sense. Sort of the outlook, especially in higher education, where everything right now is about career readiness. That's the big buzzword. I think there's a way to work with students in languages on career readiness doesn't sacrifice some of our fundamental principles about studying culture and literature and art and the cultural products. We talk about the three P's. I'm drawing a blank: perspective, product, and practice, right? I don't know if that's the right order, but products, practices, and perspectives. I see more of an expansion of those three P's into other areas than saying, well, we're only going to do very concrete language for professions, or language for business, or language for medicine things, but weaving in the other things that we've always done, like art and music and literature and TV and film and cinema, incorporating those together instead of just saying it's one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I'm really into LSP too. And Dr. Mary Reisner from the University of Florida, I work with her. Yeah, outstanding, really promoting language for specific purposes. And when you talk to big companies like Google and, even tech companies, that they're like, why would you, like, yeah, we need coders, but we need people with soft skills and that can communicate. We need more, employees that have studied another language. And I think what we do with languages for students to prepare them for the world, is that we help them to learn about their humanity, and connect to their humanity through other people. So they learn a lot about themselves, but they are able to connect and understand other people even better. And we can do that through literature. We can, you know, study great works of art. I mean, my favorite is Don Quixote, and I have learned so many life lessons and learned about myself through reading that, you know, book over and over again. And there are plenty of others. We can do it through film, movies, like you said, poetry, and that there's a great value in that. But also, I think there becomes a little bit of a disconnect because we don't take that out unless we become an artist or we become a writer or whatever. We don't take it out into the real world. Whereas with business, when we can make languages and that connection there, it is more powerful and more meaningful. And then they can connect to the arts and everything when they travel for their business job because of their languages, and they can take a deep dive into the culture, those products, practices, and perspectives. So great. Yeah, great point on that. So anything else you would like to say about teaching or some advice to new teachers? Because you're helping shape these new educators that are coming into the classroom. And I'm sure what you're hearing is they're scared, or I'm not sure if I want to be a teacher because it's just really rough right now. And also, I just had my brother called me yesterday, and he was like, so can you tell me more about these voucher schools? Because I just listened to a podcast about them. And he said, and they were saying that it's teachers are not qualified. There are teachers that are just not qualified to teach. And so we had a conversation about that. So I know, even at the state level, we've talked about that. And like, I was on a committee for the teacher certification exam. And, you know, are we really preparing the teachers for the classroom? And one of the things that got brought up was they're studying too many literature classes in college and not doing enough teacher preparedness and pedagogy classes. So what would you have to say about that?
A couple of things. So going back to the, you know, the I think curriculums and colleges are changing to meet the needs. And, you know, and so instead of taking like the survey of Spanish literature from 1800 to the present, you know, incorporating literary texts into culturally relevant classes is kind of, I think, where we can incorporate sort of the older traditional models of language teaching at the higher education to help solve this problem. But, you know, I came out with a very, very... liberal arts college with a very dense reading list at the undergraduate level. I came out with tremendous knowledge of Spanish literature and zero readiness for teaching, and was thrust into the classroom. My department chair handed me the book. So here you go. Here's the book. Here's the classroom. This is your mentor. If you have any questions, let us know and good luck. And I was probably a very, 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 I don't know, I was a terrible language teacher initially, for sure. So if you're starting out teaching language or whatever, just be aware that you're probably going to be bad the first couple of years. And your goal should not be to be as good as the teacher down the hall who's been doing it for several years. Just get through those first couple of years. Just have the mentality that I'm going to survive the first year, and then the second year will be a little bit better. Because you're, even if you've had all the teacher education in the world, until you're in that classroom and dealing with students on a day-to-day basis, it's about survival that first year. And that's advice that was given to me. Just survive the first year, and then you can start to build your files. You can start to build your mechanisms, and things will get easier. The planning, the prep will get easier. You'll be able to, you'll understand what you're doing, and you'll start to see some of the finer points that make a good educator. The things that we might say that are more art rather than science to it, where you can look at a classroom and see if a student's confused by their look on their face, or if they're really getting it and having fun. You know, those are things that takes a little bit of time to learn how to read students and read a classroom and create a classroom culture. Those are really hard things to teach. I think it takes, so I would say, A, you want to have good mentoring at your schools. B, an understanding that it is important to keep teachers, to retain teachers, because the longer they're in the profession, the better they will be, right? Fresh blood is always good, and it can infuse energy into a department, no doubt about it. But you don't want everybody to be a rookie, or you know, you're never going to get that. You need to have some sages in the department to kind of help take that energy from the newbies and direct it so it's expanding and growing. And then you want to kind of cultivate experienced teachers, and do it, you know, as much professional development as possible. Work with students outside of the classroom, even though it's exhausting. Coach, sponsor clubs, because comprehensive education is, I think students will remember more about how you made them feel and how you cared about them as an educator, rather than every little thing you covered in class. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't remember much about the Spanish that Miss Story taught me, but I remember how she made me feel as a student, and that she was proud of me and encouraged me. And that helped me in my high school career, to not just in Spanish, but overall. And I had fantastic professors at Swanee that were the same way. The late Eric Naylor, he was a great friend of mine. He died a few years ago in his 80s. But again, you know, came to me and said, I wanted to quit. You know, I didn't say this in the beginning. I wanted to quit Spanish after my second college course. I was like, I'm not ready for this. These kids have all taken AP. They've come from really, really nice private schools. And I'm not up there. Like, I can't do it. And he gave me an independent study to help me get up to speed and sort of feel more confident and correct some deficiencies that I had. And had he not done that, I probably would have just said, oh, well, you know, I've taken my Spanish, I'll go ahead and do economics and something else. And I would never have gotten into education or Spanish and had the life adventures that it's provided me, knowing the language. So,
I don't think you can really top that. I mean, that is a great end to this, and how it is about how we make them feel. And that's the most critical thing. You know, Maya Angelou said that people don't remember what you say or do, but they do remember how you make them feel. So that's a great way to end this, for inspiration for all the teachers. And thank you so much for what you're doing for the profession and for students, and especially for those new educators that are coming in to a very difficult time and context. So I'm sure they're going to be well prepared after being in your class. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I'm going to put a link to your podcast, the World Language Collaborative podcast, and I hope everyone listens and is inspired and gets great ideas and sparks for the next class period that they have to present, as you said earlier. So thanks a lot, Grant.
Thank you.
Hello again, everyone. This is your host, Linda Markley, and I'd like to invite you to nominate a teacher to be a guest on the podcast and to share their story. All you have to do is go to www.spiritofteaching.org and fill out the nomination form. Again, that's www.spiritofteaching.org. Also, please share, rate, and give some feedback to help us better serve you in the spirit of teaching. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to having you back next time on Teacher Tales.